The United States at the beginning of the 19th century is certainly different than the United States that we know today. The bureaucracy and the state apparatus is very small, developing. And so the second best solution that they were using was literally to appoint people that they trust.
Welcome to the first in a series of VoxDev talks that we're recording live at the Centre for Economic Policy Research's Paris Symposium in 2023. My name's Tim Phillips. What is the role of state capacity in economic development? More specifically, when a state sets up its bureaucracy, how does it organise it and how does it monitor the people who work in it? Nicola Mastrorocco of the University of Bologna is one of the authors of a new study of how this happened in the development of the United States. He joins me now. Nicola, welcome to VoxDev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Your study, fascinating. It covers the development of the US in the 19th century. So take us back to the beginning of this. Describe what the country's like at the beginning of the period you study.
The United States at the beginning of the 19th century is certainly different than the United States that we know today. It's a country of roughly 5 million people. Its economy is mostly agrarian, with cotton being the most important crop in the South. The North is slightly more industrialized and they are stronger in trade. And it's a country that is basically developing, literally with the capital D. And there is the Industrial Revolution that is about to kick in. Its territory is expanding rapidly. And its politics is very much at the center of the scene. And I would say, given the topic of our study, the bureaucracy and the state apparatus is very small, developing, and operating with very limited capacity with respect to peers around the world, in particular Europe.
Yes, because during all this period, what really comes through is this drive to continuously expand the capacity of the state. Why did this happen? What's behind it?
Behind that, there is certainly this vast and big and important economic expansion, territorial expansion, political expansion. So this is a state in the making. And of course, throughout this period, the question on how to actually implement, organize the state in the most efficient way in order for it to perform its function was very much at the center, was very much in the minds of the founding fathers. There are a lot of examples of historical accounts where the founding fathers were brainstorming what was the best way to organize the state, to organize what a sociologist man would call the infrastructural power to implement things throughout the realm.
We always think of the United States as the small state, shrinking the state now. So it goes against your preconceptions to see the United States growing the state so remorselessly. Now, in 1817, I'm a bureaucrat and I'm working in the central government in Washington, D.C. How do I monitor the people that work for me who are outside of Washington, D.C.?
First of all, we should say that at the beginning of the period, the organization was really centralized. So your question is really, really pertinent because it was really a manager in the headquarters, Washington, D.C., that wanted to monitor what the agents, the employees of the bureaucracy in the field was doing. And the question is, are they taking actions which are in the best interest of Washington, D.C.? It's very difficult for them to monitor because there was no way to communicate, to travel there easily. And in fact, the geographical expansion was fairly limited. And so the second best solution that they were using was literally to appoint people that they trust. And so I trust the team and I know him. So it's part of my personal connection. And so I'm going to ask him to be the manager of the custom office in Louisiana, for example. So it was a very personal type of organization.
I could see how that would solve the immediate problem, but does that cause some other problems as well?
Yeah, well, the main drawback is that this is natural in any organization. There's a limited amount of people that you can trust.
Yeah.
That's it. Your personal connection at some point ends. And so this, of course, we argue it's one of the reasons for which we do observe growth at the beginning of the 19th century, but not a rapid growth, exactly because there's a limited amount of people that you can possibly trust. And so your hands are a bit tight.
So, to investigate how the US solved this problem, especially in the second half of the 19th century, you went back to the source, didn't you? You used primary data. Tell me about this.
Exactly. Well, the vast protagonist of our study is the US Official Register, which is an official document listing basically the full roster of people that have worked in the US federal bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. This is a document that is published in every odd year from 1817 to, I believe, 1954. And we have digitized from 1817 to 1905. The document is very rich. Mm-hmm. It contains, first of all the names of the people working in the federal bureaucracy, but not only, it contains the job, it contains the salary, it contains where they were employed, and it contains where they were born and where they were employed the first time that they started working in the federal bureaucracy. On top of that, importantly and crucially for us, it contains the structure of the organization. So, for example, we know that Tim was working in the Treasury, was working in the Secretary office as a bureau, mm-hmm. and was working in the appointment division. Okay, so we know all this type of information that for us are crucial to basically do an MRI of the federal bureaucracy back then.
But I mean, this must have been a huge amount of work because it was thousands of pages.
Yeah, so the first book in 1817 was about 33 pages, and in 1905, 1,200 pages. So just the size of the book mm-hmm. gives you an idea of the spectacular growth of the US federal bureaucracy. It took us 5 years.
Yes, I can see where you spent your 5 years, because out of this you get information about someone's job and the course of their career, where they are and what they're doing. So from this, how quickly did the state capacity grow during this? It's an 88-year period, isn't it, you managed to cover?
Yeah, it's basically almost 100 years. And you're right. So to answer your question, one extra element on the data, on top of what we just described, we complemented this exactly with what you said. First of all, the geolocalization of all the places of employment using the coordinates of county in the US. And then, of course, the categorization of the occupations and the structure of the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. With those three additional complements, the first question that we investigate is exactly what you asked me, which is when did the state grow? And so what we see is that there was a very slow and steady growth all the way until the 60s, 1860s, and then there's a change of speed mm-hmm. after that. And this was actually true both in Washington, D.C., the headquarters, and what we call in the field, which is basically everywhere else but mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. And in the paper, we do a lot of work to try to understand what are the drivers of this growth. And what we see is that conceptually, a state can grow because it does more things, which mm-hmm. you can proxy with the number of bureaus, the number of functions that it performs, because it does the same thing, but more intensively with more people, or because it reaches more location. And what we see is that really in the first part of the century, the first two were predominant. So the number of function and the intensity were indeed growing, but the expansion was basically zero. So mm-hmm. the share of counties available in the US with state presence was fairly constant, whereas it literally changes speed in the second part of the century.
You put a lot of effort in this as well to investigate the personal relationships, to try and reconstruct those from the documents. Why did you put the effort into that?
Well, because one element that fascinated us and we think is important on top of the growth and where it grew is to exploit the richness of our data mm-hmm. to track the evolution of the organization over time. Mm-hmm. So literally to follow the evolution of the state apparatus. And so, for example, when we look at turnover rates, we see, and there is probably my favorite picture in the paper, we see that there are these big spikes of turnover, meaning bureaucrats leaving the bureaucracy, exactly in correspondence of the years in which the president of the United States was changing and changing color.
Right.
Using now the jargon of the agency theory, the principal, which is the president, is changing and there's a big reshuffling mm-hmm. in the bureaucracy. And so this suggests, it's one of the measures, we have many more, that suggests this personal relationship. Now, I'm not in charge anymore, and so I'm sorry, Tim, but you're not requested anymore in Louisiana. I need someone else, or whoever is going to come after me will choose someone else. states. And we see that this personal nature is changing over time, meaning it's decreasing, it's shrinking. Mm-hmm. And so in the paper, we try to assess why.
Because our modern conception of a bureaucracy is something that stays more or less intact, whatever is happening as the result of an election.
Precisely.
Or whoever's in power, the bureaucracy stays the same. It wasn't that way at the beginning. It sort of was that way at the end.
And one thing that we say in the paper without making any normative statement is that it was almost impossible at the beginning to have this type of bureaucracy that you suggested, which we might call, you know, a Weberian bureaucracy that stays constant, is based on meritocracy, does not turn over, simply because it was impossible to enforce it. Mm-hmm. And so they made the most out of it. And then with time, and we argue with improvements in the technology of controls, this transition from a more personal nature to a more Weberian nature actually unfolded.
So tell me about that, the improvement in the technology of control. What do you mean?
This really goes back to Max Weber and the work of many sociologists, where the idea is that agency problems are important in every organization. And by agency problems, I simply mean the fact that there's a principal who's in charge and there are agents, and the principal has to make sure that the agents are acting on behalf of the principal and not doing clientelistic behavior or corruption or whatever else. Our starting point is that these problems are strong in any organization, but certainly are particularly severe in a state who has to employ a lot of people over a vast territory. In the first part of the century in the United States, we are in a situation where monitoring costs and communication costs are very high. And so, as we said, the second best solution is to rely on personal connection. At some point, we think, thanks to the introduction of two technological innovations, and those are the railroads network and the telegraph networks, this cost decreased. And so for Washington, D.C., for the principal, it was actually easier to monitor what the agents were doing. And so what we do in the second part of the paper is, first of all, to reconcile descriptive facts that we show through the lens of this theory, and then to provide an empirical test, an econometrical test, if you wish, to our hypothesis.
Yes, can you make that causal connection? Because, well, in the United States in the 19th century, a lot of things happened and a lot of things changed. Can you actually recover a causal connection between the railroads and the telegraph to bureaucracy?
I think there are two separate points in this. So the first is one thing that we want to stress, and we hopefully we do our best in the paper, is that there are many mechanisms which might explain our descriptive facts, which is natural. We're looking at 100 years. So we're not claiming that ours is the only one. We claim that ours is one that has some explanatory power and the capacity to provide a unifying framework. Now, zooming into our mechanism, I think we have an identification strategy that allows us to plausibly capture causal estimates. And that is that we use leverage on data from Attac and Donaldson and Orbeck, GIS data, that basically allows us to track the expansion of the railroad networks across time in the US. And so then we calculate a measure, which is time to travel to DC from each country C at any point in time T in minutes. Okay, and we call this travel time. It's a measure that we have in log in the paper. And the idea is to show what happens when this travel time decreases. And of course, two identification concerns here, just to do a little bit of a technical parenthesis. One is that, of course, the construction of railroads in a given county C is not exogenous.
No.
It's endogenous to plurality of things. And so how do we solve this problem? So we take advantage of the fact that having a railroad is a function of two things. First, it's a tautology. You need to have the railroad in your county. And this is endogenous. And the second is the quality of the connection of the railroad with places that are further away. Because you can have the railroad there, but if it stops just after your county ends, it's not very useful. We control for having the railroad in your county. So we shut down that dimension and we just exploit the quality of the railroad's connection further away. There's a second concern, which is that this quality of the railroads away might be correlated to what has been called in the trade and urban literature market access. And market access is correlated with a plurality of things which might be confounding factors in our analysis. So we have a measure of market access that we control for in our analysis. And so that's basically the identification strategy, which allows us to basically compare counties with the same market access with a very similar railroad construction, but with variation in travel time from and to the headquarter, DC.
So we've been discussing the development of the capacity of the state. Can we stretch this to think about the economic development of the state? Is there any evidence from your research to support the assumption that we often make that state capacity drives growth?
There's an enormous literature that has actually documented in very various disciplines and in different countries and different settings this strong positive relationship between state capacity and economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And in the paper, we actually do have the same result, meaning that we show that state presence and state capacity, therefore, is more likely to be present in counties where there is a high share of people working in the manufacturing sector, which is our measure of economic activity back then. What we do not do in the paper, empirically at least, but we discuss more anecdotally, is to study whether state capacity, once it's in there and with different organizational forms that we discuss, is leading to better performance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's something that potentially we can do because we have the data to do, at least for a subset of our departments. But we wanted to focus more on the supply side here.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, the incentives to set up estates are there. How do we do it? And so that's potentially room for another paper once we're done with this.
Yes.
If ever.
Your research here is a story of how technology replaces trust. Now, we spoke earlier about how one of the problems with trust is it doesn't scale. Are there other ways in which trust, when you're building state capacity, is bad in this context?
Let me answer in two ways. First, by telling you about one of the results, extra anecdotal results that we have in the paper, and then a more general answer. In the paper, we show that if you look at the federal employment per capita,
mm-hmm.
and you look at before and after the Civil War, and you divide between federal employees born in the South, meaning in the ex-Confederate states, and federal employees born in the North, after the Civil War, there is a gap, which you might argue is a bit mechanical. There's a war going on, and so it's less likely to hire people from the Confederate states
yeah.
in the federal bureaucracy. But what is striking is that this gap doesn't converge. If anything, it widens up. So it's larger and larger in time.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that was very interesting. And there are a lot of historical accounts that were actually confirming that back then, there was a lot of skepticism and mistrust in hiring someone from an ex-Confederate states within the federal bureaucracy. So what we do, we exploit this fact and we investigate whether once these technologies of controls improve, i.e. once, for example, there's a railroad or there's a telegraph connection, you're more likely to reduce this employment gap, meaning to hire someone from the South. And we do actually find that. So I don't know whether that answer to your question, but that's a formal test that we have specifically related to trust in the paper. And so trust for us, it's an important dimension because there are important, very important models. I'm thinking, for example, about the Garicano framework that actually argues that when there is an increase in ICT, in technology of controls, you might have more centralized organizations. However, there are extensions to this model when you have trust in it, when you have the likelihood that an agent might misbehave, might engage in bribes, in corruption, then actually increasing in monitoring and increasing the technology of controls might lead to more delegation. And so both models are, of course, for us, crucially important. We wanted to see what the data was basically supporting, what the data was revealing.
The history of the growth of the United States is a remarkable story. The United States was a completely different country at the end of this century than it was at the beginning. But when we're looking at the growth of the American state, is this a story of American exceptionalism? Is it a one-off event? Or is it something that we can use to inform policy for developing states now that are struggling with state capacity?
Difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess both aspects are true, meaning there is certainly an element of exceptionalisms of the US. For example, if you compare the size of the US federal bureaucracy at the end of our sample period and the size of the French bureaucracy at the end of the sample period, so until 1905, the French mm-hmm. bureaucracy is three times larger,
right.
Which is sort of coherent with what you were saying at the beginning. The US are a small state and France is such a bigger state, more centralized. So therefore, there are some elements which are very typical of the US. But the drivers, that we described, this sort of transition from personal to Weberian, I think is something that can be generalized. And actually, it's something that sociologists that have studied early Europe, Prussia, have put forward. So that's certainly something that it's not typical and only in the US. When it comes to developing countries now, we certainly don't want to make any normative statement. Certainly, I think it's interesting to brainstorm on whether it's better, for example, in developing programs, to allow the oversight of this problem locally or to actually have a more centralized, top-down control. I think our paper can speak to that.
Well, it is a fascinating paper and a fascinating story, and one of those papers where you can see all the work that you put into it. Thank you for talking about it today, Nicola.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
If you want to read this paper, it is called State Capacity as an Organizational Problem: Evidence from the Growth of the US State Over 100 Years, and the authors are Nicola Mastrorocco and Eduardo Tezzu. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the papers we feature.